Side 17. I didn't think twice about it, but pitched my cheroot into the fire and sauntered through the lines to the chief's tent, computing my loot in my mind and drinking in the warm night air with sleepy content. Even when Campbell's greeting to me was, "How well do you know the Rani of Jhansi?" I wasn't uncomfortably surprised. There'd been a dispatch in about the Jhansi campaign that very day, and Campbell already knew about my mission for Palmerston. It all seemed a long way away now. I said I'd known her very well. We'd talked a great deal together. "And her city, her fortress," says Campbell. "Possibly, sir. I was never in her fort proper. Our meetings were at the palace, and I'm not over familiar with the city itself." "More familiar than Sir Hugh Rose, though, I'll be bound," says he, tapping the paper in front of him. "And that's his own opinion. He mentions you by name in his latest dispatch." I didn't care for that. It don't do to have generals talking about you. I didn't care for the way Campbell was looking at me, either, tapping a nail against those beautifully kept teeth that shone so odd in his ancient face. "This Rani," says he at length, "what's she like?" I began to say that she was a capable ruler and nobody's fool, but he interrupted with one of his barbarous Scotch noises. "Tach away wi' ye! Is she pretty, man? Eh? How pretty?" I admitted that she was strikingly beautiful, and he grinned and shook his grisly head. "Aye, aye," says he, and squinted at me. "You're a strange man, Flashman. I'll confess to ye, I've even on had my doots about ye. Don't ask me what, for I don't know. I'm frank wi' ye, d'ye see? I'll say that for him, he always was. This much I'm certain of," he went on. "Ye always win. God kens how. And I'm glad I don't ken myself, for I wish to think well of ye. But there, Sir Hugh needs ye at Jhansi, and I'm sending ye south." I didn't know what to think of this, or of his curious opinion of me. I just stood and waited anxiously. "This mutiny mischief is just about done. It's a question of scattering the last armies here in Oud and Rohilkhand, and there in Bandelkhand, and hanging Nana and Tantya and Azimula higher than Haman. Jhansi is one of the last nuts to be cracked, and it'll be a hard one, like enough. This besom of a Rani has 10,000 men and stout city walls. Sir Hugh will have her under siege by the time you get there, and nae doubt he'll have to take the place by storm. But that's not enough. Which is why you, with your particular diplomatic knowledge of the Rani and her state, are essential to Sir Hugh. You see, Flashman, Lord Canning and Sir Hugh and myself are agreed on one thing, and your experience of this woman may be the key to it." He looked me carefully in the eye. "Whatever else befalls, we must contrive to capture the Rani of Jhansi alive. If she'd been ugly as sin, or 20 years older and scrawny, it would never have happened. Jhansi would have been taken, and if a plain elderly Rani had been bayoneted or shot in the process, no one would have given a damn. But Canning, our enlightened Governor-General, was a sentimental fool, intent on suppressing the mutiny with the least possible bloodshed, and already alarmed at the toll of vengeance that people like Neil and Havelock had taken. He guessed that sooner or later the righteous wrath of Britons at home would die down, and that if we slaughtered too many Pandies, a revulsion would set in, which, of course, it did. My guess is that he also feared the death of a young and beautiful rebel princess, for her fame and likeness had spread across India by now, might just tip the balance of public conscience. He didn't want the liberal press depicting her as some Indian Joan of Arc. So, however many other niggers died, male and female, she was to be taken alive. Mind you, I could see Canning's point, and personally I was all for it. There wasn't a life anywhere, except Elspeth's and little Havie's, that was as precious to me then as Lakshmi Bai's, and I don't mind admitting it. But fair's fair, I wanted her saved without any dangerous intervention on my part, and the farther I could have kept away from Jhansi, the better I'd have liked it. It wasn't a lucky place for me. So I took as long as I decently could getting there, in the hope that it might be all over by the time I arrived. I had the excuse that the 200 miles between Lucknow and Jhansi was damned dangerous country, with Pandis and the armies of rebel chiefs all over the place. I had a strong escort of Pathan horse, but even so, we went warily, and I didn't sight that fort of ill omen on its frowning rock until the last week in March. Rose was just getting himself settled in by then, battering away at the city defences with his guns, his army circling the walls in a gigantic ring, with observation posts and cavalry pickets all prettily sighted to bottle it up. He was a good soldier, Rose, careful as Campbell, but twice as quick, and one glance at the rebel defences told you that he needed to be. Jhansi lay massive and impregnable under the brazen sun, with its walls and outworks and the red rebel banner floating lazily above the fort. Outside the walls, the dusty plain had been swept clear of every scrap of cover, and the rebel batteries thundered out in reply to our gunners, as though warning the besiegers what would happen if they ventured too close. And inside, there were 10,000 rebels ready to fight to the finish. A tough nut, as Campbell had said. "We'll have them out in a week, though. No fears about that," was Rose's verdict. He was another Scotsman. India was crawling with him, of course, as always. Brisk and bright-eyed and spry. I knew him well from the Crimea, where he'd been liaison at the Frog headquarters, and less objectionable than most diplomat soldiers. He was new to India, but you never have guessed it from his easy confidence and dandy air. To tell the truth, I have difficulty in memory separating his appearance from George Custer's, for they both had the same gimlet assurance, as well as the carefully wind-blown blonde hair and artless moustaches. There the resemblance ended. If we'd had Rose at Little Big Horn, Crazy Horse and Gaul could have whistled for their dinners. "Yes, a week at most," says he, and pointed out how he had sighted his left and right attacks opposite the strongest points in the rebel defences, which our gunners were pounding with red-hot shot, keeping the Pandy fire parties busy quelling the flames which you could see here and there behind the walls, flickering crazily through the heat haze. "Frontal night assault as soon as the breaches are big enough, and then..." He snapped his telescope shut. "Bloody work, since the Pandys are sure to fight to the last, but we'll do the business. The question is, in all that carnage, how do we preserve her ladyship? You must be our oracle on that subject. What? Would she personally surrender, do you suppose?" I looked about me from the knoll on which we stood with his staff officers. Just before us were the lines of siege guns in their earthworks, shaking the ground with their explosions, the smoke wraithing back towards us as the gunners, crawling like ants round their pieces, reloaded and fired again. Either side, the pickets of the flying cavalry camps were strung out as far as the eye could see. The red jackets of the light dragoons and the grey khaki of the Hyderabad troopers' coats, dusty with the new curry powder dye. 2 miles behind us, near the ruins of the old cantonment, were the endless tent lines of the infantry brigades, waiting patiently till the guns had done their work on the massive walls of Jhansi City, behind which the jumble of distant houses stretched in the smoky haze up to the mighty crag of the fortress. She'd be up there somewhere, perhaps in that cool Durbar room, or on the terrace, playing with her pet monkeys. Perhaps she was with her chiefs and soldiers, looking out at the great army that was going to swallow her up and reduce her city and fairy palace to rubble. "Mera Jhansi denge ne," thinks I. "Surrender," says I. "No, I doubt if she will." "Well, you know her." He gave me that odd, leery look that I'd got used to even in the few hours I'd been at his headquarters, whenever her name was mentioned. The popular view was that she was some gorgeous human tigress who prowled half-naked through sumptuous apartments, supervising the torture of discarded legions of lovers. Oh, my pious generation had splendid imaginations, I may tell you. "We've tried proclamation, of course," says Rose, "but since we can't guarantee immunity to our followers, we might as well save our breath. On the other hand, she may not be eager to see her civilians exposed to continuous bombardment followed by the horrors of assault. What? I mean, being a woman. What is she like, by the way?" "She's a lady," says I. "Extremely lovely, uses French scent, is kind to animals, fences like a Hungarian hussar,
prays for several hours each day, recreates herself on a white silk swing in a room full of mirrors, gives afternoon tea parties for society ladies, and hangs criminals up in the sun by their thumbs. Useful horsewoman, too.
Good God, says Rose, staring. And behind him his staff were gaping at me, round-eyed, licking their lips. Are you serious?
What about lovers, hey? Says one of the staff, sweating and horny-eyed. They say she keeps a harem of muscular young bucks, primed with love potions.
She didn't tell me, says I. And I didn't ask her. Even you wouldn't, I fancy.
Well, says Rose, glancing at me and then away, we must certainly consider what's to be done about her.
That was how I employed myself for the next 3 days, while the guns and 8-inch mortars smashed away in fine style, opening a sizable breach in the south wall and burning up the rebels' repair barricades with red-hot shot. We blew most of their heavy gun posts into rubble, and by the 29th, Rose was drawing up final orders for his infantry stormers, and still we had reached no firm plan for capturing Lakshmi Bai unharmed. For the more I thought about it, the more certain I became that she'd fight it out in person, when our infantry fought their way hand to hand into her palace. It was easy after Lucknow to imagine bloody corpses on that quilted Chinese carpet, and the mirrors shattered by shot, and yelling looters smashing and tearing in those priceless apartments, sabering and bayoneting everything that stood in their way. God knows it was nothing new to me, and I'd lent a hand in my time, when it had been safe to do so. But these would be her rooms, her possessions, and I was sentimental enough to be sorry for that, because I'd liked them and been happy there. By George, I'd got her into my bloodstream, though, hadn't I, just when I started worrying about her damned furniture. And what would happen to her in that madhouse of blood and steel? Try as I might, I could see nothing for it but to tell off a picked platoon with orders to make straight for the palace and secure her unharmed at any price. Provided she didn't get in the way of a stray shot, there was no reason why they shouldn't bring her out safe. By God, though, that was one detail I'd have to avoid. No, my job would be her reception and safekeeping when the slaughter was safely over. Flashy, the stern and sorrowful jailer, firm but kindly, shielding her from prying eyes and lecherous staff wallopers with dirty minds. That was the ticket. She'd have to be escorted away, perhaps, even to Calcutta, where they'd decide what to do with her. A nice long journey, that, and she'd be grateful for a friendly face among her enemies, especially one for whom she'd shown such partiality in the past. I thought of that pavilion, and that gleaming bronze body undulating towards me, quivering voluptuously to the music. We'll have dancing every night, thinks I, in our private hackery, and if I'm not down to 12 stone by the time we reach Calcutta, it won't be for want of nocturnal exercise. I explained my thoughts to Rose, the first part about the special platoon, not the rest, at dinner in his tent, and he frowned and shook his head. Too uncertain, says he. We need something concerted and executed before the battle has even reached her palace. We must have her snug and secure by then. Well, I don't for the life of me see how you're going to do that, says I. We can't send anyone in ahead of the troops to kidnap her or any such thing. They wouldn't get 100 yards through the streets of Jhansi, and if they did, she has a Pathan guard 100 strong covering every inch of the palace. No, says he thoughtfully, picking at his cheroot. Force wouldn't serve, I agree. But diplomacy now. What do you think, Lister? This was young Harry Lister, Rose's galloper, and the only other person present at our talk. I'd known him any time the past 10 years. He'd been a special constable with me in the Chartist farce of 1948, when I took up old Morrison's truncheon and did his duty for him, me and Gladstone and Louis Napoleon holding the plebeian mob at bay, I don't think. Lister was a smart un, though. Given a silver spoon, he'd have been a field marshal by now. Bribery, perhaps, if we could smuggle a proposal to some of our officers, says he. Too complicated, says Rose, and you'd probably just lose your money. They've eaten her salt, says I. You couldn't buy 'em. I was far from sure of that, by the way, but I wanted to squash all this talk of intrigue and secret messages. I'd heard it too often before, and I know who finishes up sneaking through the dark with his bowels gurgling and his hair standing on end in the enemy's lair. I'm afraid it comes down to the special platoon, after all, sir. A good native officer with intelligent Jawans. Council of Despair, Flashman. Rose shook his head decisively. No, we'll have to trick her out. Here's a possibility. Storm the city, as we intend, but leave her a bolt hole. If we draw off our cavalry pickets from the Orchard Gate, they'll spot the weakness, and when our rebel lady sees that her city's doomed, I'd be much surprised if she don't try to make a run for it. How well do Indian women ride? This one, like a Polish lancer. It might work, says I, if she don't suspicion what we're up to. But if she smells a rat, she'll be smelling too much powder smoke by then to notice anything else, says Rose confidently. She'll break for the open, try to join Tantia or some other rebel leader, and we'll be waiting for her on the Orchard Road. What do you say, gentlemen? Says he, smiling. Well, it suited me, although I thought he underrated her subtlety. But Lester was nodding agreement, and Rose went on. Yes, I think we'll try that, but only as a long stop. It's still not enough. Lord Canning attaches the utmost importance to capturing the Rani unscathed. That being so, we must play every card in our hand, and we have a trump which it would be folly not to use for everything it's worth. He turned and snapped a pointing finger at me. You, Flashman. I choked on my glass and covered my dismay with a shuddering cough. I, sir? I tried to get my breath back. How, sir? I mean, what? We can't afford to neglect the opportunity which your knowledge of this woman, your familiarity with her, gives us. I don't suppose there's a white man living who has been on closer terms with her. Isn't that so? Well, now, sir, I don't know. I still think we can talk her out. Public offers of surrender are useless, we agree, but a private offer now, secretly conveyed with my word of honour and Lord Canning's attached to it, that might be a different matter, especially if it were persuasively argued by a British officer she could trust. You follow me? All too well, I followed him. I could see the abyss of ruin and despair opening before my feet once again as the bright-eyed lunatic went eagerly on. The offer would assure her that her life would be spared if she gave herself up. She doesn't have to surrender Jhansi even, just her own person. How can she refuse? She could even keep her credit intact with her own people. That's it, cries he, smacking the table. If she accepts, all she has to do is to take advantage of the bolt hole we're going to leave her through the Orchard Gate. She can pretend to her own folk that she's trying to escape, and we'll snap her up as she emerges. No one would ever know it was a put-up business, except her and ourselves. He beamed at us in triumph. Lister was frowning. Will she accept and leave her city and people to their fate? He glanced at me. Oh, come, come, cries Rose. She ain't European royalty, you know. These black rulers don't care a snuff for their subjects. Ain't that so, Flashman? I seized on this like a drowning man. This one does, sir, says I emphatically. She wouldn't betray him, never. The irony of it was, I believed it to be true. He stared at me in disappointment. I can't credit that, says he. I can't. I'm positive you're mistaken, Flashman. He shook his head. But we have nothing to lose by trying, at any rate. But if I went in under a flag of truce, demanding private audience with her... Oh, who said anything about a flag of truce? Of course, that would blow the gaff at once. Her people would know there was something up. He tapped the table, grinning at me, bursting with his own cleverness. Didn't I say you were the trump card? You not only know her well, you're one of the few men who can get inside Jhansi and into her presence with no one the wiser. As a native. He sat back, laughing. Haven't you done it a score of times? Why, all the world knows about how you brought Kavanagh out of Lucknow. What do you think they're calling you down in Bombay these days? The Pall Mall Pathan? There are times when you know it absolutely ain't worth struggling any longer. First Palmerston, then Outram, and now Rose. And they were only the most recent in a long line of enthusiastic madmen who at one time or another had declared that I was just the chap they were looking for to undertake some ghastly adventure. I made one attempt at a feeble excuse by pointing out that I didn't have a beard any longer. Rose brushed it aside as of no importance, poured me another brandy, and began to elaborate his idiot plan. In essence, it was what I've already described. I was to convince Lakshmi Bai of the wisdom of giving herself up, which I reckon she'd never agree to do, and if she accepted, I was to explain how she must make an attempt to escape through the unguarded Orchard Gate at the very height of our attack on Jhansi City, The timing, said Rose, was of the utmost importance, and the further advanced our attack was before she made her bolt, the less suspicion her people might feel. I couldn't see that this mattered much, but Rose was one of those meticulous swine who leave nothing to chance. "And if she rejects the offer, as I know she will," I asked him, "then on no account must you say anything about the Orchard Gate," says he. "Only when she has accepted the offer must you explain how her capture is to be contrived. But if she does refuse, well, she may still be tempted to use a bolt hole in the last resort, if we leave her one. So we shall nab her anyway," he concluded smugly. "And I, if she refuses?" "My guess," says he airily, puffing at his cheroot, "is that she'll try to keep you as a hostage. I hardly think she'll do more than that, what? Anyway," says he, clapping me on the arm, "I know you've never counted risk yet. I saw you at Balaclava, by George. Did you know about that Lister?" he went on. "Charging with the heavies wasn't enough for this beauty. He had to go in with the lights as well. And, you know, he actually sat laughing at me in admiration. It would turn your stomach." So there it was. Again. Hell in front and no way out. I tried to balance the odds in my mind while I kept a straight face and punished the brandy. Would Lakshmibai listen to me? Probably not. She might try to escape when all was lost, but she'd never give herself up and leave her city to die. What would she do with me, then? I conjured up a picture of that dark face smiling up at me with parted lips when I pinned her and kissed her against the mirrored wall. I remembered the pavilion. No, she wouldn't do me harm, if she could help it. Unless... had she set those thugs after me? No, that had been Ignatieff. And yet, there was the Jansi massacre. How deep had she been in that? Who knew what went on in an Indian mind, if it came to that? Was she as cruel and treacherous as all the rest of them? I couldn't say. But I was going to find out, by God, whether I liked it or not. I'd know when I came face to face with her. And just for an instant, I felt a leap of eagerness in my chest at the thought of seeing her once more. It was only for an instant, and then I was sweating again. I'll say this for Hugh Rose. Along with his fiendish ingenuity for dreaming up dangers for me, he had an equally formidable talent of organization. It took him a good 30 seconds to think of a foolproof way of getting me safe inside Jansi. I would have the next day to prepare my disguise, with skin dye and the rest, and the following night he would lose a squadron of Hyderabad cavalry in a sudden raid on the breach in the city wall. They would break through the flimsy barrier which the defenders had thrown up, sabre a few sentries, create a hell of a row, and then withdraw in good order, leaving behind among the rubble one native badmash of unsavoury appearance, to wit, Colonel Flashman, late of the 17th Lancers, and General Staff. "I'd have no difficulty," said Rose breezily, "in lying low for half an hour and then emerging as one of the defenders. After that, all I had to do was to tool up through the streets to the palace and knock on the door, like Barnacle Bill." Speaking from a safe distance, I can say it was a sound scheme. Hearing it propounded at the time, I thought it was fit to loosen the bowels of a bronze statue. But the hellish thing is, whatever a general suggests, you can do nothing but grin and agree. And, I have to admit, it worked. I don't remember the agonizing day I must have spent waiting and attiring myself in a filthy sepoy uniform so that I could pass in my old role of third cavalry mutineer. But I'll never forget the last moment of suspense beside the siege guns, with the Hyderabadi troopers round me in the gloom, and Rose clasping my hand, and then the whispered order, and the slow, muffled advance through the cold dark, with only the snorting of the horses and the creak of leather to mark our passing towards that looming distant wall, with the dull crimson glow of the city behind it, and the broad gap of the breach where the watchfires twinkled, and we could even see figures silhouetted as they moved to and fro. Away to our left flank, the night batteries were firing. Distant tiny jets of flame in the dark, pounding away at the flank of the city which faced the old cantonment. That was for diversion. I could smell the bizarre stink from Jansi, and still we hadn't been spotted. Even through my genuine funk, I could feel that strange tremor of excitement that every horse soldier knows as the squadrons move forward silently in the gloom towards an unsuspecting enemy, slowly and ponderously. Bump, bump, bump at the walk, knee to knee, one hand on the bridle, t'other on the hilt of the lamp-blacked sabre, ears straining for the first cry of alarm. How often I'd known it, and been terrified by it. In Afghanistan, at Cawnpore with Rowbottom, in the Punjab, under the walls of Fort Raim, when I rode against the Russians with old Izzat Kutabar and the horde of the Blue Wolves, and that lovely witch Kodali's daughter touching my hand in the dark. The crack of a rifle, a distant yell, and the thunderous roar of the Rissaldar. Aye, squadron, charge! The dark mass either side seemed to leap forward, and then I was thundering along, flat down against my pony's flanks like an Oglala, as we tore across the last furlong towards the breach. The Hyderabadis screamed like fury as they spread out, except for the four who remained bunched ahead on either side of me as a protective screen. Beyond them, I could see the smoking glare of the fires in the breach, a rubble-strewn gap 100 yards wide, with a crazy barricade thrown across it. Pinpoints of flame were twinkling in the gloom, and shots whistled overhead, and then the first riders were at the barrier, jumping it or bursting through, sabres swinging. My front gallopers swerved in among the jumble of fallen masonry and scorched timbers, howling like dervishes. I saw one of them sabring down a pandy who thrust up at him with musket and bayonet, while another rode slap into a big white-doted fellow who was springing at him with a spear. His horse stumbled and went down, and I scrambled my own beast over a pile of stones and plaster from which a dark figure emerged, shrieking, and vanished into the gloom. There was a fire straight ahead, and men running towards me, so I jerked my beast's head round and made for the shadows to my right. Two Hyderabadis surged up at my elbow, charged into the advancing group, and under their cover I managed to reach the lee of a ruined house, while the clash of steel, the crack of musketry, and the yells of the fighters sounded behind me. Close by the house there was a tangle of bushes. One quick glance round showed no immediate enemy making for me, and I rolled neatly out of the saddle into what seemed to be a mitten, crawled frantically under the bushes, and lay there, panting. I dropped my sabre, but I had a stout knife in my boot and a revolver in my waist under my shirt. I snuggled back as far into cover as I could and kept mum. Feet went pounding by towards the tumult at the barricade, and for 2 or 3 minutes the pandemonium of shooting and yelling continued. Then it died down, to be replaced by a babble of insults from the defenders, presumably directed at our retreating cavalry. A few shots went after them, and then comparative peace descended on that small corner of Jhansi. So far, so good. But, as some clever lad once said, we hadn't gone very far. I waited perhaps a quarter of an hour, and then burrowed through the bushes and found myself in a narrow lane. There was no one about, but round the corner was a watchfire, with a few pandies and bazaar wallahs round it. I ambled past them, exchanging a greeting, and they didn't do more than give me an idle glance. 2 minutes later, I was in the bazaar, buying a chapati and chili, and agreeing with the booth wallah that if the Sahib Log couldn't do better than the feeble skirmish that had just been down at the breach, then they'd never take Jhansi. Although it was 3 in the morning, the narrow streets were as busy as if it had been noon. There were troops on the move everywhere. Rebels of the 12th NI, regulars of the Rani's Maharatta army, Bhil soldiers of fortune, and every sort of armed tribesman from the surrounding country with spiked helmets, long swords, round shields, and all kinds of firearm from mines to matchlocks. It looked to me as though Jhansi knew our main attack was soon coming, and they were moving reserves down to the walls. There were 10 civilian townsfolk about for every soldier, and the booths were doing a roaring trade. Here and there were ruined shops and houses where some of our stray shots had fallen, but there was no sign of unease, as you'd have expected. Rather a sense of excitement and bustle, with everyone wide awake and chattering. A party of coolies went by, dragging a cart piled with 6-pounder cartridges, and I took the opportunity to remark to the booth wallah, "There go 1,000 English lives, eh, brother?" "Like enough," says he, scowling. "And every cannon shot means another anna in market tax. Lives can be bought too dear. Even English ones." "Nay, the Rani will pay it from her treasury," says I, giving him my shrill sepoy giggle. "Oh, ho, ho, hear him," says he scornfully. "You should set up a stall, soldier, and see how fat you get.
When did the Rani ever pay? Or any other prince? What are we for but to pay while the great ones make war?
Just what they'd be saying in the Reform Club or the Star and Garter, thinks I. Aloud, I said,
They say she holds a great council in the fort tonight. Is it true? She did not invite me, says he, sarcastically, nor, strangely enough, did she offer me the use of the palace when she left it. That will be 3 pice, soldier.
I paid him, having learned what I wanted to know, and took the streets that led up to the fort, with my knees getting shakier at every step. By God, this was a chancy business. I had to nerve myself with the thought that whatever her feelings towards my country and army, she'd never shown anything but friendliness to me, and she'd hardly show violence to an envoy from the British general. Even so, when I found myself gazing across the little square towards that squat, frowning gateway with the torches blazing over it, and the red-jacketed Pathan sentries of her personal guard standing either side, I had to fight down the temptation to scuttle back into the lanes and try to hide until it was all over. Only the certainty that those lanes would shortly be a bloody battleground sent me reluctantly on. I wound my puggaree tightly round my head and chin, hiding half my face, slipped from my pocket the note which Rose and I had carefully prepared, walked firmly across to the sentry, and demanded to see the guard commander. He came out, yawning and expectorating, and who should it be but my old acquaintance who spat on shadows? I gave him the note and said, "This is for the Rani's hand and no other. Take it to her, and quickly." He glowered from me to it and back. "What is this, and who may you be?" "If she wishes you to know, belike she'll tell you," I growled, and squatted down in the archway. "But be sure, if you delay, she'll have that empty head off your shoulders." He stood glaring, turning the note in his hands. Evidently it impressed him. With a red seal carrying young Lister's family crest, it should have done. And after an obscene inquiry about my parentage, which I ignored, he scratched himself and then loafed off, bidding the sentries keep an eye on me. I waited with my heart hammering, for this was the moment when things might go badly astray. Rose and I had cudgelled our brains for wording that would mean nothing to anyone but her in case the note fell into the wrong hands. As an added precaution, we'd written it in schoolboy French, which I knew she understood. It said simply, "One who brought perfume and a picture is here. See him alone. Trust him." Rose had been delighted with this. He was plainly one who enjoyed intrigue for its own sake, and I've no doubt would have liked to sign it with a skull and crossbones. Squatting in the doorway, I couldn't take such a light-hearted view. Assuming that Pathan blockhead took it straight to her, she'd guess who it was from fast enough. But suppose she didn't want to see me? Suppose she thought the best way of answering the message would be to send me back in bits to Rose's headquarters? Suppose she showed it to someone else, or it miscarried, or... The sound of marching feet came from the gloom beyond the archway, and I got to my feet quivering. The Havildar came out of the dark, with 2 troopers behind him. He stopped, gave me a long, glowering look, and then jerked his head. I went forward, and he motioned me on into the courtyard beyond, falling in beside me with the 2 troopers behind. I wanted to ask him if he'd given the note to the Rani personally, but my tongue seemed to have shriveled up. I'd know soon enough. As my eyes became accustomed to the gloom after the glare of the torches by the gate, I saw that we were heading across the yard, with high black walls on either side, and another torch at the far end, over a doorway, guarded by 2 more Pathans. "In," growls the Havildar, and I found myself in a small vaulted guard room. I blinked in the sudden glare of oil lamps, and then my heart lurched down into my boots, for the figure peering intently towards me from the centre of the room was the little fat chamberlain whom I knew so well from Lakshmi Bai's Durbar. The stupid bitch had told him who I was. There was no hope of a secret offer now. Rose's fat-headed scheme had sprung a leak, and... "You are the officer who brought gifts from the British Queen," he squeaked. "The Sarkar's envoy, Colonel Flashman?" He was squinting at me in consternation, as well he might, for I didn't look much like the dandy staff officer he'd known. Sick and fearful, I peeled off my puggaree and pushed my hair back. "Yes," said I, "I'm Colonel Flashman. You must take me to the Rani at once." He goggled at me, his little eyes wide in that fat face, twisting his hands nervously. And then something fluttered in the air between us. For an instant I thought it was a moth, and fell to the floor with a tiny puff of sparks. It was a cigarette, smoking on the flags. A long yellow tube with a mouthpiece. "All in good time," said Ignatieff's voice, and I believe I actually cried out with shock as I spun round to stare in horrified disbelief at the doorway. He was standing there, his hand still frozen in the act of flicking away the cigarette. Ignatieff, whom I'd supposed 1,000 miles away by now, looking at me with his dreadful cold smile, and then inclining his tawny head.
"All in good time," he repeated in English, as he came forward. He ground his heel on the fallen cigarette. "After we have resumed the discussion which was so unfortunately interrupted at Balmoral."
End of side 17.